Welcome back. I'm Doc Coleman, and this week I have a very special episode of the Balticon 47 wrap-up in store for you. This week's episode is a very special reading from the upcoming Way of the Gun anthology. The Way of the Gun was created by Scott Roche, and it is a shared world anthology set in a world where the principles of Bushido guided the gunslingers of the Old West. Some fight as noble marshals bringing law to the lawless. Others have been seduced by power and authority. Joining Scott Roche in the anthology are Zachary Ricks, Jared Axelrod, Jake Bible, Justin McCumber, and myself. Since Justin and myself were going to be present at Balticon, we set up this special sneak preview reading of our stories in progress. Unfortunately, Justin was called home by a family emergency, but thankfully, Christiana Ellis and Veronica Jaguer were willing to step in and help with the reading. Recorded on May 26th at 11 p.m., I am pleased to present to you Words of the Gun, a sneak peek at three stories from the Way of the Gun anthology. After a short introductory letter from Scott Roche, we get started with the first story, The Gun with the Glass Chamber, by Jared Axelrod and read by Christiana Ellis. Next up is Veronica Jaguer reading Jake Bible's story, Geared for Evil. And finally, an excerpt from my own story, The Shining Cog. We hope that you will enjoy this sneak peek into these three stories, and that when the anthology is finally published, that you will delight in finding out how each story ends. The anthology is still in editing, and we hope to have a release date late in 2013. So please keep checking back for more information. To find out more about The Way of the Gun, go to www.scottroche.com/WOTG. Enjoy! All right, it's 6 after 11, so I guess we're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you, everyone, for coming out, and hopefully people will gain better taste and come in as we get started. This is the Words of the Gun reading. We're doing readings from a shared world anthology called The Way of the Gun, and this was put together by Scott Roche, and he invited several of us, of which I'm the only actually author who managed to still be here at Balticon. My name is Doc Coleman. Before we start off with the actual reading, I actually have an introductory note from Scott explaining the whole thing, and he regrets that he was not able to make it here to Balticon. All right, now they're getting loud. Just go ahead and close the door. When they start distracting me, it's bad. All right. Scott writes, my name is Donald, a.k.a. Scott Roche, and I'm a blogger, podcaster, author, and editor for Flying Island Press. I've been a fan of Westerns all of my life and have always wanted to write one. Thanks to Jared Axelrod, I got an idea for a setting and a brace of characters a few years ago and began writing a story. As occasionally happens, I put the story away to let it simmer. This year, I took it out of the drawer and started working on a novella. After sending it around to some friends, I decided to open up the universe to a select few authors and see what they would do with it. Imagine the gunslingers of the Old West with an honor code similar to a samurai's Bushido, the way of the warrior. These marshals and rangers, along with the followers of the clockworker, fabulous tinkers and healers, are in conflict with an increasingly corrupt justice system led by the judges. The short stories in this anthology will have all of the action and adventure you'd expect from a Sunday matinee shoot 'em up, with a dash of philosophy and tension as ancient codes deal with an increasingly modern world. In addition to my own story, this anthology will contain works by some of my favorite authors, Jake Bible, the mind behind Dead Mech and The Americans, Justin McCumber, author of the military sci-fi novel Haywire. Zach Ricks, editor of Flagship Magazine and author of his own Weird Western series. Jared Axelrod, creator of the rich world behind Fables of the Flying City. And Doc Coleman, podcaster and author of the steampunk series The Adventures of Crackle and Bang. So we've got most of our stories in, and we're still doing editing, but we expect to have the book released by this time next year, hopefully. If you'd like to find out more about the way of the gun, you can go to www.scottroche.com/thoughts, and Scott will be posting news on the project as it becomes relevant. And so now I'd like to go ahead and do some selections. Now I have selections from my story, from Jake's, and from Scott's, and I believe Christiana, you have some of Jared's.
Yes, Jared Axelrod asked me to stand in on his behalf.
And unfortunately, Justin was here, and he was called away because of a family emergency rather suddenly, and I don't believe he had a chance to hand off his story to anybody. But do you want to go ahead and start?
Sure. I will go ahead and start. Hold on. I had it open. Ah. This is a selection from the beginning of Jared Axelrod's story, The Gun with the Glass Chamber. A white hat takes flight, while a snake of steam and steel crashes to the dust. Do Wan did not feel comfortable in her white hat. The felt was stiff, new. It hugged the sides of her head while being too long in the front and back. Do Wan was told by her master that it would form to her head as the sweat of her brow broke down the pure white material. All Do Wan had to do was walk long enough in the desert, and the hat would fit as if it was made for her. In fact, the damn thing flew off the moment the train crashed. Do Wan was not supposed to be traveling by train. It was the marshal's way to walk the waste, the emphasis being on the word walk. But Do Wan was tired, and the train was coming into the station, and a kind soul had seen Do Wan White Hat, and, in honor of a marshal who had done her a good turn years ago, had given her money enough for the ticket, and maybe a rice ball while she was on the train. And what did it matter anyway? She was traveling through the wastes, wasn't she? And wasn't that the spirit of the order, if not the letter? It was just through the east of the, pass, on her way to the Middle Kingdom. Do Wan was very confident in the rightness of her decision, up until the train derailed. Do Wan found out later that enterprising bandits had removed a section of the rails, causing the train to twist off the track and sprawl out like a lazy cat in the sand. The momentum of the back cars crushed up against the front, causing the train as a whole to turn on its side, sending all of the occupants tumbling out of their seats. The first thing Do Wan did was check her holster and make sure her gun was still in one piece. She held it up to the light slanting through the windows that were now right above her, inspecting the gun's chamber for any possible crack. The glass was intact, its single bullet undisturbed. Do Wan breathed a sigh of relief as she slid this pistol into her holster. All around Do Wan was chaos. People were screaming in surprise and agony. Everyone was trying to leave the train in the quickest way possible, trampling the injured on their way out. It was a mess. Do Wan was trying to figure out the easiest way to leave herself when she felt a tugging on her robe. "Marshal?" a small voice behind Do Wan said. "Is this your hat?" Do Wan turned to see the young girl holding the white hat with her two chubby hands. Do Wan took the hat from her and patted her on the head, right between her black pigtails. "Yes, it is. Thank you for returning it to me." Do Wan stood tall as she placed the white hat on her head and adjusted the brim. There was work to be done here. Marshal's work. And Do Wan was a marshal. The occupants of the train car were scattered about. They stumbled to their feet and rubbed sore shoulders. The shopkeeper and her family seemed uninjured, just rattled. The old monk in the back readjusted her robes as if the crash had been nothing more than a heavy wind. The clearly wealthy merchant had a torn coat, but was checking over the luggage with such speed that she couldn't be seriously harmed. A long-legged woman in goggles and leather, who had been asleep at the beginning of the journey, had found herself a comfortable spot and resumed her nap. A baby wailed, but the father quickly silenced it with a mouthful of milk. Doan climbed over the upturned seats, moving from one side of the car to the other. Her fellow travelers seemed self-possessed and capable. There seemed to be little need for a marshal. "Marshal?" a faint voice called out to Doan's right, coming from underneath a pile of fallen carpets. Doan wasted no time in tossing the heavy material aside, revealing a plump, ancient woman. Her clothes carried the shabbiness indicative of old favorites, but her ornate earrings spoke to how easily she could have replaced the clothes if she wanted to. There was blood in her white hair. "I saw your hat," the old woman said. "The white hat above everything else. It was all I could see. I've never seen a marshal on a train before." "We don't usually ride them." I'm glad you rode this one." The old woman started to get up, but it was clear that the action was more than her legs could handle. Doan caught her, glad that all those years hauling water up the stairs at the temple had made her arms like steel. "Allow me to assist you, grandmother. My name is Doan."
"A boy's name?"
"Yes. How did you know?"
"I, too, have my roots in the land of the morning calm. It's been such a long time since I've seen any shade of my kin, much less a marshal with a boy's name."
"My mother wished for a son above all things. She got a marshal instead."
"Her daughter became a marshal, yes, but she never got to see it. How are your legs?"
"They have never been good. I've spent most of my life sitting, I don't mind telling you. I've been very fortunate in that way."
"There is nothing wrong with good fortune," Doan said.
"And I am grateful for it, just as I am grateful for you, Marshal. My life, it has been charmed."
The old woman sent a hand to her side and proceeded to pat her pocket, searching. She looked back to where she had fallen and breathed a sigh of relief.
"Ah, Doan, could you get my wallet for me? It dropped when I fell."
"Certainly, grandmother." Doan made sure that the old woman was sturdy, leaning against the overturned seat, and went for the wallet. It was a large thing, a leather bundle ornately carved and shellacked to resemble a tortoise shell. It carried the weight of wealth to it, filled to bursting as it was with papers and bills. Doan handed it back to the old woman.
"A lot of money in that, grandmother."
"It's not the money that's important. It's..." The old woman's words were drowned out by the sounds of gunfire outside the train. As a marshal, Doan had been trained in the sounds and smells of gunfire. The staccato rat-a-tat-tat might as well have shouted that the gun was a Thompson, and the oily stickiness to the gunpowder was a stench unmistakably belonging to the Tayusan arsenal.
Middle Kingdom soldiers?
Unlikely. The bursts of fire were random, wild. These were not soldiers. These were bandits. The thunder of automatic gunfire had scattered what remained of the train car's passengers. Only Doan and the old woman remained. It was clear that even with Doan's help, the old woman would not be able to leave in a hurry. Certainly not fast enough to outrun a bullet from a Thompson submachine gun.
"Stay low, grandmother," Doan said. She flipped back her robe, revealing the gun with the glass chamber, snug in its holster. Only its handle showed it looked like any other pistol. Doan hoped the sight of an armed marshal would be enough to dissuade any bandits. She could not protect the entire train, but at the very least, she could protect the injured old woman. She could do that much. The bandits blew the train door apart, launching splinters through the air. Doan abandoned her defiant posture immediately and crouched to shield the old woman. The bandits tumbled in one after another, each with a red armband, their weaponry and clothing a patchwork of Middle Kingdom, Empire of the Sun, and Gaikokujin styles. Helmets with segmented neck guards and ornate crests worn over mouth-obscuring bandanas.
Woven straw sandals peeked out from leather chaps. Silk robes closed with broad sashes under dusty frock coats. Curved swords, short mountain bows, broom-handled pistols, melon hammers, and of course the oily, noisy Thompsons, were gripped anxiously by meaty, nervous fingers. The whole crowd brought an odor of sour rice wine and fermented tofu, and it made Dowan's nose crinkle. The bandits lined the train car, making a path down the middle of the overturned vehicle. Strutting down the car, placing one long leather-clad leg over each ruined seat with the grace of a dancer, came a woman decked out in shades of red, from her kimono to the twin gun belts that it kept closed. "Stay away from the old woman," the bandit in red said. She had a holstered pistol on each hip, but she held a long curved sword. Most of her face was covered with a red scarf, but her eyes were outlined in coal and were unmistakable. "I hear it's bad luck to gut a marshal, but I'd rather not test the theory if I can help it." "You will not touch her," Dowan said. She straightened, regaining the defiant spine of a marshal. She kept her gun in her holster, but dramatically moved her robe back so that the bandit could see how easy it would be to reach for it. "Be on your way." "I leave in my own time. Now stand aside."
"I will not."
The bandit in red turned back to the ruffians behind her. "Someone go find one of the monks on this train. If this brings me bad luck, I want that curse removed pronto."
The bandit swung her curved sword in a violent arc, shaped to cut Dowan in half at the waist, but Dowan had anticipated her strike and leapt up, gripping the frame of the window above. Dowan pulled herself up, only to swing back down and slam her foot into the red bandit's face. The red scarf fell around the bandit's neck, revealing a black tattoo around her lips like a smile drawn in ink.
"Leave while you can." Dowan was in fighting stance now, her robe covering her pistol. "No marshal pup tells me what to do." The bandit brought her sword up with a wheeling flourish before it slammed down on the marshal's face. Such a forceful blow could have cleft a head clean in two, hopes and dreams and all. It would have, too, if not for Dowan blocking the blade with the barrel of her gun. The glass chamber rang with the impact, but, to Dowan's relief, did not shatter.
"You're bold, pup, but I'll teach you how to heal yet."
The bandit in red swung her sword again and again, great graceful swipes of violence and power. Each one was blocked by the steel of Dowan's gun. While the bandit in red was on the offensive, she nonetheless found herself herded by Dowan's parries. The young marshal was moving the bandit further and further away from the old woman. The bandit in red's sword strokes became wild, angry. She extended herself too far, allowing Dowan to flip the pistol in her hand and disarm the bandit with the butt of her gun. Dowan gave the tattooed smile a crack, too, sending the bandit to her hands and knees. The bandit wiped away the blood that oozed from the corner of her lips, brilliant scarlet against the black of her inked skin, and looked up to see the barrel of the gun with the glass chamber staring her in the face.
"You gonna shoot me, Marshal?"
And I don't think we mentioned the name of the story.
Oh, The Gun with the Glass Chamber.
The Gun with the Glass Chamber.
And it's by Jared Axelrod.
All right. And now Veronica is going to act as our stunt reader, standing in for Jake Bible, who could not make it here, but he sent his story.
Okay. So this is Way of the Gun, Geared for Evil by Jake Bible. Marshal Elkins leaped out of the way of the offal being tossed about the grassy meadow. "Watch what you're doing, Milo," he exclaimed. "You're going to splatter the kid." "What is it, Marshal?" I asked. "Don't know, Lane," Marshal Elkins replied. "Ain't never seen its like before." "Oni," Milo said. He pulled his arms out of the creature's belly. Blood and filth stained his skin up to his elbows, and he spent a minute shaking the gore from his hands, then wiping them on his already stained vest. "Oriental demon." He kicked a pile of guts with his toe, revealing what remained of a human hand clutching a pocket watch. "This one just fed." "Like from China?" I asked. How'd it get here, to the Oregon Territory? Nippin, Milo replied, nudging the creature's corpse with his boot. It's Jap, and it could have come over on any one of those trader ships that steam up the Columbia. Damn, Marshal Elkin swore. If there's one, there's more. We're going to have to go hunting. Flush out the catacombs. But I thought the mayor said he didn't want us down there anymore, I said. Didn't Judge Hobart say that the catacombs and Portland in general are off limits? Leave that to the city to handle? The judge did say that, Marshal Elkins nodded. But who's going to tell him? Marshal Elkins and Deputy Marshal Milo both gave me a hard look. It was the keep your mouth shut and we'll be all right look. I squirmed. My mother had taught me not to lie or deceive in any way. It was one reason I was training as a deputy marshal myself. The way was the most honest life a man of good could lead. I don't know, I started to say. Milo rolled his eyes and shook his head. Kid, you have to understand that the way ain't black or white. Sometimes it's blood red. When it's that color, then we have to make hard choices. Judges are the law, but they're also sitting pretty. We're out in the shit, kid. And when you're in the shit, you get dirty. Marshal Elkins nodded. Well said, Milo. He gripped my shoulder, firmly turned me, then walked us away from the demon corpse. Now, Deputy Marshal Tanner, why are you here? I'm sorry, I asked. Why are you here, Lane? Are you here to fight the evil that threatens to wash over us at all times? Or are you here to only follow the law, even if it means innocents can die? Well, I don't want no one to die, I replied. Of course you don't, Marshal Elkins said, looking back at Milo. None of us do, not even Judge Hobart. But the judge only sees the big picture. That means he misses the details. Our job is to catch and kill those details if need be. So we're just helping the judge, I asked, still not feeling right about it. Exactly, Marshal Elkins smiled as he clapped me on the back. And those details are more than likely in the catacombs. We're just going to go have a look, kid, Milo said. If there's nothing down there, then there's nothing to worry about. If we do find something, though, we take care of it, Marshal Elkins finished. That's the way. I thought about it for a minute or so, and I could tell the Marshal and Milo were getting impatient, but I couldn't just push the conflict in me away. Kid, Milo pushed. We ain't got much time. Only breed like rats. We gotta go now. I looked at Marshal Elkins. You promise we ain't going against the way? I promise, Marshal Elkins replied immediately. On my soul, Lane. I nodded to him and started to walk to my horse, but something in my gut stopped me. I turned around and looked over at Milo. His face was pale white, and the corners of his mouth kept twitching up and down. You all right, Milo? I asked, backing toward my horse, my hand going for the saddle. My palm found the custom stock of my father's rifle, and I slowly pulled it from its sheath. You don't look so good. Milo looked down at his gore and blood-stained hands. Feeling kind of itchy, he muttered as he flexed his fingers. Kind of itchy all over. Maybe you should take a rest before we get going, Marshal Elkins said, his hand going to the long blade at his side. He loosened it in its sheath with a practiced flick of his thumb. The sound seemed to echo across the meadow, and Milo's eyes narrowed, focusing on the marshal. What you do that for, Marshal? Milo asked. His eyes darted around the meadow, barely focusing on anything. You think there's danger? I don't know, Milo, the marshal replied. Is there? I took a couple of steps toward the deputy and slowly raised my rifle to my shoulder. Milo didn't like that, and he bared his teeth, actually bared his teeth like a wolf or a rabid dog. What you gonna do there, kid? Milo hissed at me. You ain't man enough to use that rifle. The rifle, a heavily modified Henry repeater, was given to me by my mother when I told her I was joining the way. It had belonged to my dead father, who was the Oregon Territory Marshal before Marshal Elkins. There was no other like it in the world. It was one of the first repeating rifles made by Benjamin Tyler Henry, who gave it to Father as a gift when he saved Mr. Henry from a nasty encounter with a succubus during a way meeting out east. Pretty much all rifles had wood stocks, but mine didn't. Featuring a hand-forged stock made from Tahamagane steel, the rifle was both a firearm and battle axe. The stock was shaped perfectly so that the curve of the blade fit just under my armpit, letting the steel butt of the rifle rest against my shoulder just like a normal rifle. I kept that blade edge so sharp that my sheath had to be reinforced with tin and heavy leather, or the jostling from riding would let the rifle slice right through. "Hey, now, Milo," Marshal Elkins said, his voice even and calm. "No need to get personal." Milo doubled over from a sudden coughing fit. Red-black phlegm flew from Milo's mouth, splattering the tall meadow grass. I could see it took all of the Marshal's willpower and training not to step back. "Marshal?" I asked cautiously. "What's happening?" "Oni," Marshal Elkins said. "There are many species. We don't know them all. This one may have poison in its blood." "You just figure that out on your own, dipshit?" Milo asked between hacking coughs. "Good thing you're in charge." Milo shook his head like a dog with ear pus. His lips curled back so far I thought they'd rip right off his face. His exposed teeth were now a deep black, and I guessed it was from the phlegm, but as I watched him, I could actually see them lengthen. First they were normal, then they weren't. "Marshal," I said, my finger resting heavy on my rifle's trigger. "Just take it easy, Lane," Marshal Elkins said calmly. "Let's not rush things. Everyone, stay calm." Those were the last words he ever said. Milo's mouth widened, his head nearly splitting in half. His tongue shot out at the marshal. The man that was my mentor didn't even have a chance to scream. Milo's tongue punctured his neck and ripped it right open. It tore through the flesh and wrapped about the marshal's spine, yanking him off his feet and into Milo's arms. The sounds of bone crunching as Milo began to feed would haunt me for years, if I lived that long. "Marshal!" I screamed as I pulled the trigger. A bullet went right through the top of Milo's head. It didn't do a damn thing except make Milo drop the marshal and turn towards me, his eyes red and full of rage. Oh, shit. I was ready for the tongue, and when it came at me, I threw myself into the grass, rolling to my side. I whipped the rifle from my shoulder and spun it about, using the forged grips on the barrel to steady the weapon, its blade ready to kill. "Tasty little bitches," Milo said. But it wasn't Milo's voice anymore. It sounded like it was covered in ground grass and buried at the bottom of a fresh grave. "There's a spice to the way, better than the rabble." I stayed in a crouch, stiller than anything around me, my entire being focused on Milo, just as I was taught. "What you gonna do with that shiny hatchet, kid?" Milo asked, his body lurching and jerking as he stepped toward me. "Gonna chop some wood? Some wood?" His head slowly twisted around, but his mouth stayed in the same place. The gray hair that had been on the back of his scalp fell away, showing me two new eyes, both large, both lidless, both bright red. Milo's body stopped moving and began to expand, like a bladder filling with water. "You ain't Milo no more," I said, more to reinforce my determination than to make conversation. "Whatever you are has to die."
Thank you.
Veronica, had you ever seen that story before now?
No.
Amazing.
But, yay, Jake, but it was off my bucket list.
He's right.
Awesome. You're
All right. Thank you very much for guest reading. And so now I'm going to do a selection from my story, The Shining Cog. It has been said that God does not play dice. Many people have interpreted that in different ways. Some believe that this is an injunction against gambling in all its forms. Others feel that this is an indication that our lives are predestined, that all of our actions were set in motion by the great clockworker before the world was wound, and that we can do none else but what we are shaped for. But brothers and sisters, I do not believe that either of these is correct. God does not play with dice because the clockworker would not use such an ungoverned system. Before the great wheels were set in motion, he knew that eventually those wheels would go wrong. And where they have gone wrong, some hand must realign them, reset their timing, and send them into motion again. As cogs in his great machine, this is our purpose, my people. We have been built with the power to see glimpses of the great working, and with this divine insight, we can do our best to push the great wheels of fate to mesh properly. This is our calling. Not to tick and turn idly along our span of serviceable lifetime, but to seek out what has gone wrong in the world and set it right. We must repair the great work so that the great wheels continue to roll towards his purpose. That is what it truly means to be a cog. The mechanic Armand Tinwicket. Speeches from the Great Nevada Windup. Mr. Fong brought another pot of tea. The grizzled old man had ridden into town 2 days ago. He'd rented a room in Miss Abigail's boarding house, then sought out Mr. Fong's cafe. Other than sleep and other usual personal maintenance activities, for the past 2 days, the stranger had sat at a table in front of the cafe and drank pot after pot of Mr. Fong's tea. Alex Copperspring and Horatio Hammersmith eyed the stranger from across the street in the saloon.
"Lex, I'm worried," the old carpenter said, sipping whiskey from his glass and looking through the dingy windows of the saloon.
"I know, Horatio. I'm worried, too," Alex replied. This wasn't the first stranger to come through town, but this one was different. Most of them just stayed for a night and moved on the next day. Some would spend an extra day to restock their supplies before moving on again. This stranger just sat at Mr. Fong's and drank tea. But that wasn't what really worried Alex. What bothered him most was the fact that the stranger had a pistol strapped to his leg. In Alex's experience, guns meant trouble. Not that Alex had a lot of experience with guns. The problem was that you never knew what kind of man carried a gun. Well, you could figure out a little. The man wasn't a hunter. Hunters carried rifles, which, while just as deadly, were designed for taking down a whole different kind of quarry. No, a man who carried a pistol pretty much meant to use it against one thing: men. Of course, there are some that say that carrying a pistol out on the frontier is just a wise move, as one never knows when one is going to be surprised by wild animals or wild Indians. Some folks take the position that the Indians are just another kind of animal, but Alex never took by those notions. Wild men were men just the same, no matter how strange their customs may be. All were shaped by the clockworker and set in motion by his hand. From all Alex had heard tell, a man carries a pistol, he's either in trouble, looking for trouble, or he's a wayist. The wayists were the best and the worst of the lot. A man who is in trouble, he may be jumpy, always afraid that he's been found out,
but he'll generally keep his head down and try not to bring on any more trouble than he already has. A man who's looking for trouble, he's safe enough as long as he's entertained. It is only when he gets bored that he gets dangerous. Neither of these sounded like the weather-worn man who sat drinking tea at Mr. Fong's. That meant he was a follower of the way of the gun, and much more dangerous. The best of the ways, they brought law and order to the frontier, protected the innocent, and never drew their guns while there was an alternative. There were less and less of those these days. You were much more likely to run into the corrupt sort. The ones that had used their skills and their power to lord it over honest, hard-working folk. Ones who took money to twist the law back upon itself until it broke clean apart. Either kind was deadly as a snake and twice as fast. Alex looked at the man across the street and wished that he could tell which kind this man was. Miss Elizabeth moved up to the table and swept up the empty plates in front of the two men. Hammersmith made a grab for the bottle of whiskey as if he was afraid that she would sweep it away as well. Almost as an afterthought, he poured another shot into his glass. Alex surrendered his empty beer glass to the saloon keeper's daughter, and she rewarded him with her own commentary.
You two are acting like a pair of fools. If you really must know the man's business, why don't you go and talk to him? Be a sight better use of your time than sit here fretting like a pair of moon cows. And if you can't bring yourself to talk to the man, maybe you could stir yourselves to do some work instead of sitting around here all day. Elizabeth! The old man O'Toole barked at his daughter. Don't be scaring off the customers! Give it a rest, da, she called back to him with a flip of her long red braid. You're not going to lose custom from me encouraging these two to go out and work up a thirst. It's not like there's another saloon in the town. Her father grunted back at her, then went back to stocking bottles behind the bar. Elizabeth turned back to the two men, who were still staring warily at the stranger across the street. Da's not the shiniest cog in the workshop, but I expected better of you, Alex Copperspring. Most of the time you've got a good head on your shoulders. Why don't you use it? With that, she turned and stalked off with the dish to the kitchen with the dirty dishes she had collected. That girl is too mouthy for her own good, Lex, Hammersmith said, and then broke into a leer. But awful good to look at. True enough, Horatio, Copper Spring replied with a sigh. But she's also right.
What?
The old man blinked in confusion. We both got work we should be doing. The crew from Midlands and Pacific could be coming over that horizon any day now, finally bringing the railroad through. Our job's not done till the station's done and the rails are laid. Horatio shook his head.
Lex, the railroad was due to come through 2 years ago. We're ready.
Alex grabbed his hat and stood. We're ready for the crews to arrive, but we're not done, Horatio. You're still working on the station office, and I still need to rebuild that pump for the water tower. That's the job Midlands and Pacific gave us when they sent us out here. We'd best be about it. That man may be a gunslinger or a weas, but so far, he's minding his own business. We'd best be about ours. Settling his hat on his head, Alex dropped a coin on the table to cover his tab. Billiards later? He asked Hammersmith. The older man smiled and answered, Only if you promise not to make any of them fancy shots all around the table. Alex laughed and headed out the doors of the saloon. He blinked in the bright sunlight as he stepped onto the porch in front of the building. Pulling the brim of his hat forward to shade his eyes, Alex shuffled forward, then stepped down into the street. Across the street, Mr. Fong registered Alex's presence with a deep bow. Alex nodded. Afternoon, Mr. Fong, he said with a wave. The stranger simply sat at his table and sipped his tea, not turning his head or even recognizing the other men. He didn't seem to have
He didn't seem to spare any attention to any of the other folks on the street going about their business. He just sat, sipped, and waited. Next section's a bit long. Would you like me to go ahead, or shall I stop there? Go ahead? Okay. Sighing, Alex turned up the street and began to walk towards the house of the clockworker. The house marked one end of the town. The other end was marked by the circle. In most townships, the circle occupied a prominent position in the town square, but Bowman's Station was a town settled primarily by followers of the clockworker. Some folk, like the Hammersmiths, followed the carpenter. Most of the farmers and ranchers that supported the town followed the shepherd. While no one in Bowman's Station followed the way, the law declared that each town must have a circle for the resolution of disputes. A few of the townsfolk had argued against building the circle, but in the end, they'd settled for moving it to the edge of the settlement rather than risk the wrath of the law. As a result, the town had taken on a barbell-like appearance with a single main road between the circle and the house, and all the main shops and businesses clustered along it. Families either lived above their shops or in separate dwellings behind them. These formed a secondary street ringing the town. Farther out, of course, were the farmhouses and the farms that provided the needs of the occupants of Bowman Station. Alex angled to one side of the street as he walked, aiming towards his workshop across the street from the house. He was fortunate to have such a prestigious place for his workshop. On the other side of the street, where it parted to go around the house, stood the station and the platform. While the rails had yet to be laid down, the site had been mapped for the station and the yard that would one day service the railroad, and most of the buildings had been built already. Wide, cleared lanes marked the path that the rails were destined to take to the station, and to the rail yard where the trains could be refueled and repaired. Alex needed to stop by a shop to pick up a few tools, then head over to the yard and get to work on the pump that filled the water tower for the trains. He was still lost in thought, cataloging the items that he would need, when two more strangers nearly rode him down. These men had come down through the path that the rails were to take into town. Now they'd ridden around the station and down the main road, paying no attention to the townsfolk on the road. Alex jumped aside as the pair bore down upon him. They continued down the street at a gallop, only checking their progress when they finally came up to the circle at the far end of the street. One of the pair, the smaller one, cursed loudly as they turned their horses around. Even from as far away as he was, Alex could hear the man yell, "What kind of a back-assward town is this? Don't these dumb shits know the circle's supposed to go in the center of town?" Alex couldn't hear the reply of the larger man, but he could see him draw a pistol from his belt. The two of the men trotted back towards the center of town, and the armed men fired two loud shots in the air, instantly gaining the attention of every person on the street. "Listen up, people!" The larger man's voice boomed down the suddenly silent street. "Gather around!" He glared at the dumbstruck townsfolk for a moment before bellowing again. "Come on! Move it! I don't intend to scream my full head off! Get over here, people!" The people in the street slowly drew forward towards the two strangers, reluctant to come closer until he returned his gun to its holster. As he replaced the weapon, he opened his coat enough that a dirty metal badge could be seen pinned to his shirt front. Folks came out of their shops to gather in the street by the two men. Alex found himself drawn down the street by his own curiosity over who these strangers were and why they had come here. "All right, people," the man cried again as a scowl crossed his face. "I'm Marshal Thaddeus Black. This is Acolyte Joshua Stone." He gestured to the smaller man. At this distance, Alex could clearly see the pistols strapped to each of their legs. The man drew a stiff card out of his coat, unfolded it, then proceeded to read from the card. "After a review of the pertinent documents, it is the ruling of Judge Wilcox that Midlands and Pacifics did indeed fail to register a proper claim for the land in this territory, and for permission to build structures upon said land. Pursuant to this ruling,
Judge Wilcox has found in favor of the claim of Hanson Cumberland and has ceded this entire valley unto his possession.
Alex could feel a fire burning in his chest.
Cumberland? The cattle baron? That old bastard. I'm sure Cumberland paid a hefty sum to get the judge to rule that way. Old robber baron had probably been doing his level best to delay the railroad until he could lay claim to this valley. Now I bet he'll lease the right-of-way right back to Midlands and use the railroad to move his cattle to market after turning this whole valley into his private grazing lands. Alex could feel his hands clenching into fists. But the marshal wasn't done yet. He sneered as he continued.
By order of Judge Wilcox, all residents of this valley are hereby declared trespassers. The judge is, however, willing to grant the following amnesty for those who remove themselves, whatever possessions they can carry, from the valley in the next 24 hours from this reading will be granted amnesty. Any who remain after the amnesty will be shot as trespassers.
He dropped the card and addressed the gathering crowd.
You got that, criminals. The judge has given your unworthy hides a gift. Grab what you can and be over the horizon before this time tomorrow, and you're free. Stay, and we start shooting.
The marshal gave a cruel smirk to the crowd and laughed at their alarmed murmurs. Thank you. Now, technically, that's our time. But there's nothing following this, and we do have a segment from Scott's. Would you like to hear Scott's, or do we go look for fun? We want to hear from Scott.
When does this come out again? When does this come out officially?
We don't have an official release date yet. It's when it's done, it comes out. I know Jake's Bible has been through the editor and has been approved and is final. The rest of us have submitted ours to the editor and they're still under review. But we still have a couple people who are still working on theirs, but we hope to have it out within the next year.
So okay. Melly said continue and then she left.
Yeah, the person who said continue has just left. Do you want me to continue? You can set a time limit. I'll read till the time. I mean, I got 8 minutes till midnight. You're turning in the pub. All right. Well, let's go ahead and stop it there then. Thank you for coming out, for the reading. I hope you will continue to look forward for new news on the Way of the Gun anthology. As I said before, you can go to Scott Roche's website and look for more information. Also, we raised some capital to fund this anthology through Indiegogo. So if you go to Indiegogo and search for Way of the Gun, you can find our project. And if you were smart enough to be a backer, you will see updates as they come up on Indiegogo. If not, I think you can still see the official announcements. And you can always go and bug Scott on Twitter, a spiritual tramp, and say, get things moving. We want this book. All right. Thank you very much.
Paige and Dr. Smar.
I hear it first. Laughing.
Yes, I am a creep.
Nah. No, go ahead.
Spinning signs.
Yeah. Now we just need we need web shooters from here so they walk by. Snag him in for your own good.
This is a Western theme of last
time. Yeah, that's true. All right, steam-powered web shooters. It's a little steam-powered.
Yes!
That's what I want for Christmas, steam-powered web shooters. Ooh.
Now picture an entire steam-powered, like, Marvel universe.
Like steam-powered Iron Man.
How has that not happened already? It has to have, right?
DC.
Bastards.
Actually, in the dealer's room, I mean, it's closed now, but at least yesterday, they were selling, like, leather versions of, like, Iron Man's, like, jacket thing, and it had, like, a little, like, Lightning thing.
That's true.
The
leather version.
Oh, yeah? I have to check that out.
That explains an overheard.
I think the light was replaced by a round spring.
Yeah, it was.
Don't walk by. Walk in. Walk into the room.
You want to listen to
Steve. You really do need someone with a little spinning arrow.
Yeah.